Mr. Chairman, while Mr. Travis is coming up, you should have -1 amendments. Do not be afraid by the volume of them, because Mr. Travis will explain them to us, I'm sure. Basically, what this is the Oregon Law Commission's juvenile code revision. As you probably remember from us dealing with juvenile issues, it has its own language, and Mr. Travis will explain that this is its an attempt at making it consistent throughout, even though this has been amended over the years.
All right, Mr. Travis.
Good morning. Timothy Travis with the Oregon Judicial Department, appearing today on behalf of the Word Usage Work Group, which is a part of the subcommittee on juvenile law, which is part of the Oregon Law Commission. I have distributed something called Questions and Answers to Senate Bill 69, which I also distributed individually to your offices yesterday. What I'm handing you today is sort of an updated, corrected version of what you got yesterday. As committee counsel said, this is, in essence, a housekeeping bill. What is happening here is that the language of the juvenile code has changed over the years. The statutes known as the juvenile code have been written and rewritten many times over the past 50 years, and several different sets of policies or assumptions or theories or whatever you want to call it have reigned in juvenile court over the years. And each of them is sort of left behind like driftwood on the beach, the legacy of some language, words of art, things that meant a specific thing at a specific time. But because that fad or that phase or that policy is gone now from juvenile law, that word has been left behind, and all it really means to us now is what it means in the dictionary. So we end up with words like custody and adjudication and disposition and wardship that mean different things to different people and mean different things as they're used in different places in the code. What you have before you in Senate Bill 69 is an attempt to simply straighten out the nomenclature, if you will, of the individual young people who are involved in our system. We have currently in our system children, and children are defined as people who are under the jurisdiction of the court because they've been abused or neglected. We have youths who are young people who have been accused of committing an act which, if committed by an adult, would be a crime. And we have youth offenders who are young people who have been found, adjudicated, to have actually committed that act which, if committed by an adult, would constitute a crime. And the reason that it's important to keep these titles, if you will, straight is because if a statute says it applies to a youth, then it applies to a youth, but it does not apply to a child or to a youth offender. And what's happened is, since Senate Bill 1 passed in the 1997 session, the language which created this scheme, the language was not completely harmonized through all of the statutes. And there are some examples in the handout that I gave you which explain how this can be a problem. Specifically on the bottom of page 3, where it says, why is the usage of the term child changed? If you go out and talk to people on the street and ask them what a child is, they'll tell you that a child is a person who's under the age of 18. But under our system, a person under the age of 18 is not a child. A person has to be a child has to be within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court because they've been abused or neglected. You see how confusing this is getting? So what's happened is that under our proposed change, we're going to call people who are under the jurisdiction of the court because they've been abused and neglected wards. And we're going to return the word child to mean what it means to you and me and my mom and anybody else in the world. A child is a person under the age of 18. And in that section, why is the term child changed, the usage of the term child changed, is an example of how confusing this can be. If you have a child and you want to, you can take your child to the authorities and have your child fingerprinted and photographed as a means of identification, as a means of child protection. In case your child is ever kidnapped, you can provide the fingerprints and photograph to the authorities. But because this statute is in 419A250, it's in the juvenile code, it says you can take a child to be photographed. Technically, a person to be photographed would have to be an abused or neglected child. So the term child is used in two different ways in the juvenile code, and that's one of the things that this straightens out. Do I have any questions so far?
Senator Ringo.
So where is the term child defined?
The term child is defined in ORS 419A004.
And you're not changing that?
Actually, yes, we are changing the definition of the word child.
What section in this bill then will define child?
That is in, I don't have the amendments with me. That should be, excuse me just a minute. That is in section 1 on page 2 on line 4, and you will see that child, the definition of the word child, is actually omitted. And if you look now over on page 5 on line 18, we now have a definition of the word ward. And that means a person is within the jurisdiction of the court under 419B100, which is the dependency. So by removing the definition of the word child, we've returned the term child just to its normal meaning.
So my question was, are we defining the word child in the statute?
No, we're not. No, we're removing the definition of the word child so that it no longer, if you look at what the definition of the word child was, that's what is now a ward.
No, I understand.
So the fact that the word child is not defined specifically for the purposes of the juvenile code returns it to its normal meaning.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. This seems like you're making the intentional decision not to define it, to give it its English usage.
Thank you. Yes, that's exactly right, Senator. Thank you.
Okay. And that's a good idea, that we don't want it defined?
We do not. No, we don't want the word child defined, because these words are defined as they are used within the juvenile code, and if they're not specifically defined in a term of art kind of way, then normal English usage kicks in.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And the definitions that we're talking about only apply to the juvenile code. They don't apply to any other part of the statute.
That is correct.
Thank you.
So the word child in the divorce statutes is not impacted by how it's defined in the juvenile code.
Thank you.
Or not defined.
Okay. Go ahead.
I would be pleased to answer any questions that you might have, rather than take a lot of time explaining this. I know this is hyper-technical and probably not very interesting.
It's easy to muck up a hyper-technical bill. question, I guess, the counsel, you had a question. Some folks had an amendment or a potential amendment about clarification with respect to federal funds.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to, I think Mr. Travis already knows this, that there was an issue of changing, I believe that the Dash 1 amendments would change the term ward to only apply to dependency cases, and there was just an issue that we were going to look at as this goes through the process of making sure that doesn't impede the flow of federal money to children who are in the delinquency statutes.
Great.
And so, Mr. Travis, did they talk to you about that?
Yeah. Thank you, Craig. If the committee will look at page 4 of the questions and answers, it says, is there any opposition to Senate Bill 69? There has been some concern that's expressed by the juvenile directors that kind of came up late in the process in regard to removing the concept of wardship from the delinquency statutes. The term ward of the court used to, you got to go back to the time when the delinquency and the dependency statutes were one. And what happened at that time, it was possible for the court to not only take jurisdiction of the child, but to make the child a ward of the court. The statutes for delinquency and dependency were separated in 1991, so that we had a dependency code for abused and neglected children and a delinquency code for delinquent children. Many of the provisions that were in the combined code were put into both codes, if you will, and the dependency code is 419B. The delinquency code is 419C currently. So what happened was that this provision that you could make a child a ward of the court was put into both the dependency and the delinquency codes, and that had to do with the fact that there was a time when we believed that delinquency and dependency were very much related. And we had a parens patriae model, if you will, for both dependent and delinquent children. When Senate Bill 1 passed in 1997 and revamped the entire juvenile code, parens patriae was removed as a concept for delinquent children. The state no longer had a parens patriae relationship with kids who were delinquents. We went from a best interest of the child model in delinquency cases to a model of public accountability and public safety. So the parens patriae concept no longer exists on the delinquency side. And yet here's this thing about wardship on the delinquency side. So we're removing the concept of wardship from the delinquency side because no one can tell you what it means if a kid is a ward of the court in a delinquency case that has any difference whatsoever to the idea of the kid being within the jurisdiction of the court. In other words, the jurisdiction of the court is a concept this big, but wardship does not increase or decrease that concept. It's simply a word, a term, as I say, that's like a piece of driftwood left on the beach from a previous time. Now, there may be some circumstances in which some federal money requires that a kid be a quote-unquote ward of the court. And if that turns out to be true, then we have a fix to make it work. So that's what the controversy is, or the perhaps controversy is too strong a word because we're all dedicated to making sure that it comes out right. But that's what this is about in terms of wardship and the delinquency code. Have I just like confused everybody totally?
No. So basically, you want the word removed and you'd like it to stay out. However, common there may be a time in which it has to be defined for purpose of receiving federal funds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that sounds like a pretty simple fix to me.
Well, it will be if it's necessary.
All right, and we want to wait around and find out if it's necessary? Or?
Well, what we would like to do, Senator, is we would like to pass the bill, because it's getting late in the session. We would like to pass the bill.
Late. We're going
to
be here a while.
I know, but you're going to be closing down your committees.
No, we're not.
And we would...
No, we're not. Who told you that?
You mean those notices that I'm seeing around the hallway in my tent, in my...
What have I ever steered you wrong?
In my...
Trust me.
Senator, you're not a lawyer. How can I trust you?
Sworn to uphold the law of the Constitution of the United States.
Our idea was to move the bill and find out, and then if we need to change it on the House side, we can change it on the House side, and then we'll send it back for a conference.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll hold it over, and I want you to fix it and
okay.
Bring it back next week.
If that's what you want to do, sure.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. If it, you know, we were like 3 weeks out or something. I'd agree with you. All right. No other questions. We'll close the public hearing on 69. Tim, thank you very much for your very adept and thorough conversation. So, next up, Senate Bill 431. And let me see. The proponents of the bill, I believe... Marianne Anderson, I think you're one of the chief proponents of the bill, correct? Why don't you come up and kind of lay a foundation for why you support the bill and bring whomever you want with you. Okay.
Senator Menas.
Go ahead, just state your name for the record and proceed.
Okay. My name is Marianne Anderson. I live in Friday Harbor, which is up in the San Juan Islands in Washington. And I'm a children's and a family advocate. I have a master's degree from Portland State University in early childhood education, and I've been a researcher, a teacher, principal at Oregon Episcopal Schools. I'm a retired flight attendant from United Airlines, and I've spent my professional life working with children. I'm also a grandmother of five, of which one child is in a sole custodial household in Oregon. And when our daughter was forced to go to court to fight for custody, the judge made a finding that the father was the epitome of an abuser. The daughter, our daughter, was the fit primary caregiver. The child, 2 years old, was awarded to the father, economic reasons. I have no vested interest in court-mandated custodial decisions, and I am a supporter of Senate Bill 431. Basically, this bill takes family law out of the family-unfriendly courts and puts it in the hands of the parents with the guidance of a mediator. And this allows the parents, not the courts, to decide what is in the best interest of their child. By presuming joint custody as early as possible in the court process, the parents are impelled to attend to the child's needs, thereby encouraging mature behavior, discouraging divisive conflict. The parents are moving ahead. They're not moving back over past grievances, which are always brought up in a custodial fight. While sole custody seeks to restrict the other parent's access to his or her child, joint custody seeks to save the child from the loss of a parent. I would like to quote Senator Farioli, because I truly agree with him that this bill takes the puck out of the game. It requires parents who are seeking divorce to go to mediation and to devise a parenting plan that will best meet their family's needs and their children's needs. There's a statistical data that I think is very alerting to the state of Oregon. In the early 1980s, joint custody of children developed as an alternative custodial arrangement for divorcing families. But by 1985, 30 states had enacted statutes specifically authorizing joint custody awards. And by 1992, this number had increased to 41 states. I overheard one of the opponents to joint custody stating that California had gone back to sole custodial, or they had gone back to requiring parents to go to court to fight for custody if they don't agree. And all of the research that I have done uses California as a model, that not only do they require divorcing parents to go to mediation, but there's a teeny little segment of parents who simply don't agree on anything. And so California has begun a program. Several jurisdictions have special masters where they are trained to arbitrate with the parents, and this has been a very successful part of their joint custody program. This bill was written to protect parental rights from court-determined custodial arrangements, to prohibit the most obstructive parent from seeking sole custody for personal gains, and to protect the best interests of the child, who has a right to shared parenting when both parents are fit. And inherent in the express public policy is a recognition of the child's right to equal access and opportunity with both parents, the right to be guided and nurtured by both parents with equal rights, and the right to have major decisions made by the application of both parents' wisdom, judgment, and experience. And the child should not have to forfeit these rights when their parents divorce. And yet the state of Oregon, there are 300,000 non-custodial families in the state of Oregon. And the statistics that we have and the statistics that I've provided for you are just major supporters of joint custody because it is in the best interest of the child. And in the Annie E. Casey's highly renowned and well-researched-based data book on Kids Count, the preteen and teen well-being in Oregon ranks worse than in an overwhelming majority of the states. And Oregon's high school dropout rate is among the five worst in the nation, and Oregon Health Facts vital statistics for 2001 show that 30.4% of Oregon births are to unwed mothers, that 66 births and 56 abortions were to girls between 10 and 14, and the research once again shows that those children who are forced to live in sole custodial arrangements have lower self-worth. Actually, they have sense of rejection. One half of their family is just basically wiped out of there's a saying that says the stars in a child's constellation, one half of those stars are literally wiped out, because in sole custody it's been a nasty, divisive, expensive, biased procedure, and it's very difficult to get above that when you're trying to raise your child. And consequently, children who are raised in sole custodial households don't have the benefit of the other side of the family. And this is a real shame, because grandparents are very important, and the other aunts and uncles are extremely important in a child's sense of being. I would like to just read one brief opinion, which went to the Court of Appeals. It then went to the Supreme Court. This is in the state of Georgia. But I think that it brings everything together. And it says, in a unanimous opinion, although the dispute is symbolized by a versus, which signifies two adverse parties at opposite poles of a line, there is in fact a third party whose interests and rights make of the line a triangle. That person, the child, who is not an official party to the lawsuit but whose well-being is in the eye of the controversy, has a right to shared parenting when both parents are fit. Inherent in the express public policy, once again, is a recognition that children have rights, and they should not have to forfeit these rights when their parents divorce. This court was heard by the state or the Supreme Court of Georgia, which upheld the Court of Appeals findings that absolutely joint custody was in the best interest of children when the parents are fit. Any questions?
Go ahead, Senator Brady. Go ahead. I'm formulating some terms.
I really commend your efforts to get the child's interest put first and to take it out of the confrontational atmosphere of a courtroom and put it into mediation, put responsibility on the parents to, you know, get their heads together and do the right thing for their children. But I did have a question about there are obviously some parents who are not, it would not be in the best interest of the child to have any custody.
There are provisions in the bill that provide for the safety of the child.
If I could finish my question here.
Oh, sorry.
Go through the chair when you respond.
On page 3, it has a protection there. It says the court shall order joint custody of a child unless the court finds that one parent is unfit for reasons including mental stability, substance abuse, and domestic violence. My question to you and maybe to counsel is, with the emphasis being on mediation and getting things out of court, how is the court supposed to determine that? What's the machinery? I can't see anywhere where there's a real process for the court to determine cases, or at what point in the negotiations does the court make that determination?
I think that there has to be an amendment to this bill to address that. that there needs to be a preponderance of evidence that a parent is a batterer, because there are false allegations. And if there is a preponderance of evidence that one parent is unfit, then it goes to the court.
I think that the real key element as you address that will be, and maybe some of the other witnesses will get to this, or maybe counsel has some ideas, but at what point is that finding made? Because that is in itself a very confrontational proceeding. So does that happen before you go through this parenting plan development and mediation, or does that happen during it? You know, I think it needs to be clarified how many parents we're really dealing with at the front end before you go through a process.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, Judge Legert is here. She's a Marion County Circuit Court judge that handles these cases. I'm going to defer to her.
Thank you.
Ms. Anderson, go back to your case, your situation with your daughter, and tell us a little bit more about the judge and the judge's decision in that case and
okay.
Some of the factual circumstances.
Our daughter initiated divorce from her husband after 7 years of domestic violence, and they were required to go to court, and her daughter was 2 years old. She was the primary caregiver, the fit primary caregiver, and she was a stay-at-home mom. She did not work. Her husband was described by the judge as the epitome of an abuser. He was a traveling salesman. The judge awarded him custody.
Is the judge's comment in the record?
Yes, it is.
Do we have copies of the record?
I can get the transcript.
We don't have those today?
No, I don't.
What county was that in?
Multnomah.
All right, and who was the judge?
Judge Kirshner.
Judge Kirshner? Okay. All right, anything else?
I would like to say that judges do not have training in early childhood education. It's very difficult for them because it's an overburdened court system. And child custody cases have become the most litigious part of the state caseload. And it just simply does not make sense when two parents are fit, and I know that there's a small percentage of parents who are not fit and should not have custody of their children, but I'm not addressing that segment. But these parents should not have to go through a very costly, emotionally demeaning procedure in front of a judge who really only hears two attorneys arguing for the best interest of their client to make a decision and to remove a child from one of his parents' protection. And
so let me ask you this question. So the judge in this case made a comment with respect to the person she ultimately gave custody of your grandchild to. Were there other comments with respect to why she did not grant custody to the daughter?
She didn't feel that our daughter had the economic means to support her daughter.
All right, so it was an economic issue with your daughter, the judge in this case?
She looked at the economic issue and not at the child.
All right. Other questions? Senator Brady.
I still can't understand it. Did the judge ever make any explanation why someone that the judge had defined as an abuser would get custody? Was there ever any attempt?
She told the court that she could do anything she wanted to do with child custody statutes because they were vague, and that she decided that in the best interest of the child, even though the MMPI test showed that the father was capable of strangling mothers, children, and if he was not successful in that, that he could attempt a very serious suicide attempt on himself. That was the MMPI that was read in court.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, so that's the Minnesota Multi-Personality Inventory. That's a psychological test. Mm-hmm. But did the judge have other... I guess it's hard for me to resolve a judge who would make the statement that someone was the epitome of abuser and then giving sole custody to that person.
Senator Burdick, this is why I have been so involved in trying to change Oregon's custodial laws so that it's on an even board. And I, Representative Minnis sponsored a bill 3 years ago to stop this type of ruling, and the with Senate Bill 1075, Senator Q-Tub and Representative Minnis, and it prohibits batters. That can no longer happen. It prohibits batters from seeking sole custody of their children, and that was a direct and acknowledging the primary caregiver, and that was in direct relationship to what happened to us in Multnomah County.
So the problem that you're presenting to the committee today via Senate Bill 1075 from the 99 session, that issue's been resolved.
It has been resolved.
All right, and it's clear in the law now that an abuser cannot have custody or sole custody.
Right.
All right, Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Good morning. It sounds like that you want to encourage mediation.
I do.
My understanding is that there already is court-mandated mediation programs when there's a custody dispute.
There is.
So mediation is already occurring.
Mediation is already occurring, but if parents disagree, they still need to go to trial. It is still the judge's decision.
Right. So at the end, though, I mean, you can't make two people agree with each other. And oftentimes in divorce, they hate each other. And I just don't see how you're going to get – you've already got mediation required. How are you going to compel people to agree?
Senator Ringo, there are statistics, two pages of statistics, that show the advantages of joint custody, even in the most contentious cases, because now they are forced to work in the best interest of the child, and in fact they do.
Obviously, we're speaking in generalities. A lot of divorcing parents don't need the court's intervention.
That's
because
right.
They get along. A lot of other divorcing parents need a lot of court intervention because they're bad parents to begin with, because they've got substance problems, and because they just hate each other, and they need a lot of court intervention. Correct? I mean, you've got lots of different cases going on.
That's correct.
Okay. I guess my point is, I just don't see how the court is going to make people be good parents if they're not going to be good parents on their own.
You can't legislate morality. We have no... We cannot make bad parents become good parents. This bill protects parental rights, because it allows the most obstructionist parent to say, I don't agree on joint custody, even though these parents are fit. This is the population group that this bill is targeting. Of course, you're going to have parents that, quite frankly, should not have had children. But we can't devise a bill that's going to... help them resolve their difficulties, but what we can do is to help the parents who are fit parents who, for an economic gain...
Oh, Mr. Chair, I would rather just ask you questions and let you answer my questions.
Oh, I'm sorry.
On page 4 of the bill, at the top, subsection 6, it says, both parents have a fundamental right to equal parenting time.
Yes.
Okay. Does that mean that you want the court to require that a child shall spend equal time with both parents?
No, that is a presumption, and that the parents have their parenting plan discussed and approved by them through a mediator. So if they want equal time and that fits their family...
No, but that's not what this says, ma'am. This says both parents have a fundamental right to equal parenting time.
That's correct.
Okay.
But just for clarification, though, and help me understand, because if you go on and read that, it says that governments may not intrude upon without first showing a compelling state interest, which that doesn't seem inconsistent with
that, I guess,
why governments, you know, do or don't do things they do. So
I guess, Mr. Chair, my concern is I don't know what it means by showing a compelling interest, but let's say absent that, then does this appear, if this appears to me to require equal time, and if that is the intent, okay, 1 week in one house, 1 week in another house, 4 days here, 3 days there, I want to know what that's intended to do.
Once again, the parents decide in their parenting plan how they're going to divide residential care.
And what if they can't decide? What if they can't agree?
Then after 90 days, they do go to court, and the court presents a parenting plan for them. So there's an incentive for these parents to agree in lieu of having the court give a parenting plan to them.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. We've got a ton of people that want to chat on this issue. We've got Judge Legert, who I believe has a 9:30 appointment, so I want to get to the judge on and have her speak to the bill.
Thank you. My name is Terry Legert. I'm a judge here in Marion County, chair, members of the committee. I apologize. I have written testimony. I did it last night about 9 o'clock, and I printed out myself and made a mistake, so I'm going to have to submit it this afternoon. And I'm going to attach, based on the other person's testimony, some statistics or studies on joint custody issues that come, and there's a myriad of them. I just want to quote one just so you can see there isn't a unanimity of opinion about whether these are a good idea. The Washington State Parenting Act study of 1999 decided that joint parenting, requiring joint parenting or 50-50 shared parenting arrangements are only appropriate where parents have good relations. They can harm children where parents' relations are conflicted. A shared or 50-50 residential schedules have adverse consequences for children in high-conflict situations and do not promote parental cooperation. So that's just a quote from one, and I'll give you the rest of them. So it's not...
Well,
yeah.
I want to go to the legal question, the legal issue.
Sure.
Here,
go right to the legal issue. I'll just make a couple other comments later.
And tell me, when is it appropriate that the state's judgment is substituted for the judgment of the parents? I think that's kind of the heart of the issue that Senator Ringo raised here.
Right, absolutely. I just want to say, Senator Ringo, Chair Minister Senator Ringo, in our county, we are able to mandate mediation. In most cases, there's exceptions, domestic violence, where there's an unequal power situation. You don't want to send to a private mediator because the person that's more powerful and abusive coerces the plan, you know, which is inappropriate. There might be mental health issues where, you know, somebody just mentally isn't capable of doing it for reasons, you know, that don't make, because again, the power issue comes into play. But we send, and I just want to digress 1 second. I believe, and I haven't asked every single judge in the state, but every judge in the state would like to have mediation. The problem is a fiscal issue. And our mediation is paid for through filing fees by the parties that file the domestic relations cases. In some of the smaller counties in eastern Oregon, they don't have the resources to do it in every case. They don't have people available. So the judges have been doing a lot of training internally to help us be more cognizant of those issues. I'm on the State Family Law Advisory Committee, and that includes mediators, custody study evaluators. And we know, the counties that are able to use it, that those parents coming up with that plan that works for them is the best thing to happen. I'm going to switch real quickly to the detailed parenting plan, and part of my testimony talks about this. When you mandate a detailed parenting plan, and at first I have to say, I thought, great idea. We'll tell them exactly when, you know, they need to see somebody. When you mandate that the parents have to come up with one, and they're high-conflict people, and they don't agree, first of all, if they can't come up with their own, I have to come up with one. What am I going to do? The only way I'm going to figure out how to do it is either have a hearing, which fiscal impact kind of pops into the schedule, you know, the issue here, on what are all the issues in your family. Where do you go to? How do you go to work? Where do the kids go to school? What's the best thing for the kids? Who do they like to play with? What house do they like to live at? What do their teachers say? You know, so you're calling in these people. I need witnesses to help me do that. Or I have a default detailed parenting plan. And in a lot of counties, we have default suggestions. And the parenting, the mediators, the people that aren't lawyers, the people that deal with these people say, you know, that kind of highly detailed thing, first of all, it doesn't work in all situations. Let's say you work on the weekends, and I'm giving you every other weekend. That's my in our county, our default plan. You know, that doesn't work. Or let's say your schedule changes every week. You know, some people work in retail. They don't get their schedule till the Friday before. They have to be flexible. What about the kids' schedules? You know, what school are they going to go to? Maybe the 10-year-old's doing great at this particular middle school, but if they spend 50, this is another issue when you talked about 50%.
I want to bring you back to the,
sure.
the core issues here.
Yeah.
I mean, we can talk in hypotheticals.
But yeah, well, I'm just saying it's like come up.
And
yeah.
I know that your plate is full when you try to sort these cases out.
Yep, thank you.
I do understand
thank you, Jim.
That part of it. I think Senator Farrell has got a question, I believe.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Sure.
First of all, I'd like to thank the judge for making testimony. I can't think of maybe one or two occurrences where we've had anybody from the judiciary at the level of judge come testify. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I think we're getting wrapped around the axle of this concept of the detailed parenting plan and losing sight of the issue that I think is germane in this case, and that is could you define for me what is a rebuttable presumption?
Okay, Chair, Senator Farrelly, that means that when you walk in, we're going to presume that this is going to happen. It's rebuttable. Somebody can present evidence contrary to it. But you walk in sort of with a step up is what we're saying.
Okay.
Otherwise, we come in with no clue about what's going to happen.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I think that's the issue here that's most important in this bill, and that is that I get a lot of traffic mail invitations to get in the middle of these issues, custody questions all the time. I'm sure everybody here does as well. And it seems to me that the first, you know, we have a couple of caveats that don't apply that seem to get pushed into the equation all the time. First in time is first in right. Somebody runs to the attorney first, and then they initiate these proceedings. And even though Oregon's a no-fault type of a state, we seem to see that whoever takes the initiative seems to be on the offensive, and the other party seems to be on the defensive, even though that's really not supposed to be part of this proceeding. And then the issue is that the custodial parent seems to automatically have the moral high ground in our cases, and it seems like maybe the old saw that possession is 9 points of the law gives the custodial parent more control than the non-custodial parent. But the presumption of, which is rebuttable, the presumption that both parents have equal parenting responsibilities and equal parenting access, to me seems to put everybody on a flat playing field. And that presumption is rebuttable, and I assume that attorneys will rebut. I'm certain that what they'll do is push the envelope if they think that there's a flaw in one of the parenting sets or parenting skills or fitness to parent, and that'll be argued in front of the court. But I saw value, maybe not necessarily in mandating a parenting plan that cannot be overruled by the court. I question whether that's the best approach, but I do see some real value in the rebuttable presumption. The joint custody is where you begin. And I'd like to hear the judge talk about that.
Thank you, Chairman and Senator Farrelly. There's a couple of things that are kind of mixed up in this bill, and part of it is how we use two things as if they mean the same thing. One is joint custody is different than 50% parenting time. I have many cases where custody is given to a particular parent so that they can make those immediate decisions or have decision-making power on things like what school they're going to go to, medical decisions, things like that. But I give the other parent 50% parenting time because that's appropriate in that case. And, in fact, that concept that both parents need to share equally and it is a very important concept, and it's something that we're pushing with the parents all the time. We have parent education classes they have to go to before they go to mediation. I was checking with almost every county in the state has that parent education, and the only thing they talk about is you put your kids first. They need both their parents. Don't degrade the other parent. It's very unhealthy for the kid to hear you degrade the other parent. You might not like them, but they're still half them, that sort of thing. Well, anyway, so the 50% sharing and having that, you know, be a good idea and something that we propose, absolutely. I do that. I don't have any problem with that. That is appropriate. And then we look to why you shouldn't do it in particular cases. Traveling salesmen live far away. You know, should the kid have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning so that they can spend half of the week with, you know, the other parent because they live in Portland, Salem, or something. But anyway, but the problem in this bill and the mandatory rebuttal presumption on joint custody is that we raised the standard of proof to get away from it, to clear and convincing evidence. There's only three grounds basically listed in the statute to get away from it, and I can think of many others that would be appropriate. Like, for instance, you don't get along, so when the child needs to get major medical, have a major medical decision, and you two can't agree because you have joint custody, you're back in court. And then you end up back in court on every joint decision. And if you get letters on some, you multiply it by 10, that's how many I get. and anyway, that's what they found out. And when you force the joint decision-making between parents that aren't good and appropriate parents and can't do it on their own, it just raises the level of conflict. And one of the things they say about people in a lot of conflict is you want to disentangle them. You want to make it so they don't have to talk to each other or meet with each other because it just keeps that digging going on, that conflict going on. So there are some parts of it that I don't disagree with, like the mediation or, you know, surely 50% parenting time are important. The other thing is some of the issues, the first-in-time issue, not anymore. That's been changed. Used to be a person could go to court with a divorce, file the divorce, first one that filed, got a temporary order giving them custody. That doesn't happen anymore. Can't happen anymore. The only way that can happen is if you get a family abuse prevention order. Then you're first in time because we have to give that person custody. So we do have, you know, charging down to the courthouse on the FAPAs to get that advantage. The other thing is we don't have, there is no presumption that if you have the person with custody right then wins. Used to be. That's what the way it was 20 years ago. It's not anymore. And we've actually made a lot of fixes to deal with a lot of the problems, particularly the woman that preceded me. She acknowledged, and I was going to say that, yeah, that domestic violence last session made it clear that there's a presumption if domestic violence is involved, that's, again, you don't get a leg up. You know, in fact, you're the opposite. You have to prove that you should have parenting time or custody. So there have been, the legislature is making little tiny changes. There's a lot of things in this bill that would increase the fiscal impact in our docket, drive our docket. We already, in my county, where we already have mandatory mediation, the contested domestic relation cases, they drive our docket. I'm going to include that in the testimony with Smith this afternoon, statistics. I didn't have them last night when I was working on this, but we already have a lot of hearings. When you start making little changes, it just drives our docket, makes it more. And when you start saying there's a presumption of joint custody, there's no incentive in mediation for them to mediate anything else. So I'm going to guess we're going to get less mediation resolve cases because you've changed the mix of what should happen in there. But, you know, like I said, there's a lot of things that judges, I'm sure, would be, you know, and we're trying to do and understand from a child development standpoint, things like 50% sharing parenting time.
Okay, Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Judge. You know, I think there's lots of problems with the bill, but I do think that when one party is labeled a non-custodial parent, there's a stigma that goes along with that labeling. You know, they, for whatever reason, they may feel emotionally degraded when that label is stuck on them. And I'm wondering whether there's a way to change that label so that maybe they can both be called custodial parents, and yet you're not requiring people that are going to fight to work together. You're not going to require people to go to court when there's a medical decision or a schooling decision to be made.
Yeah, Chairman, Senator Ringo, I agree with you completely. One of the things that has come up in a couple of my cases when they're fighting about joint custody, is some of that emotional issue. And I'll say, what is it you want to have joint decision-making about? Let's just say you're joint custodians, but this is how we're going to divide the decision-making up. You know, and that's how we've resolved it, you know, so that we had the joint decision-making, we had the independent decision-making line, you know, lined out about who's going to make what decisions, but they're really joint custodians. And I will say, just if I could finish, I talked to a family law lawyer yesterday. That's all he practices, a local attorney. And he said, you know, it is kind of funny because what does joint custody mean? What's really important is what you're making joint decisions about. And so I would suggest that as a way, prior to, just one thing we've done that I think has been helpful, we call them parenting plans instead of visitation. Again, that was to say, it's an involvement issue. It's not visiting your child. It's your child. You need to be responsible for it. The same thing we could I would suggest we should be able to talk about. I'd like to do it in a thoughtful way with all the people at the table to say, what kind of language came up with? Because you're right. Absolutely right. Why should we say you're a non-custodian?
You know? Chair, just explore that a little bit further. I mean, would it be possible to say that both parents are custodial parents, and yet the parenting plan would empower one of them to make those key medical decisions, key education decisions, so that you're not going to have people running to the court and you avoid that problem?
Yeah, I'd love to explore how we, you know, word that to make sure we don't increase litigation.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brady.
I think it'd be helpful if you would explain the difference between legal custody and physical custody. Sometimes those concepts get mixed up, and I think that would be helpful to this discussion.
Right. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I'm not sure. Those terms sometimes are used in the juvenile context as well, so that they have sort of different meanings depending on what we're talking about. But, you know, any particular person, when we talk physical, that's when you have a hold of them. You know, a legal custodian has all those decision-making and power of attorney and, you know, making all those life-changing decisions or affecting decisions on the child. So that's physical just means I have a hold of the kid today.
Well, yes, but yeah. I guess my point was you could have people have joint custody of a joint legal custody of a child, and yet that child may spend most of their time with one parent because of the situation. So they make the decisions in concert with each other, but that those decisions might mean that the child is in the physical custody of one parent way more than the other. And I think people misunderstand that when they talk about joint custody. They assume it's half and half,
right.
Physical as well as legal.
Right. Chairman, Senator Burdick, you're absolutely right. I think you probably explained it. I don't know what you want me to add to it, but I agree with what you're saying. That's why when I was answering Senator Farioli's comment or questions, I was saying there's the 50% parenting time, and then there's the joint custody. Those are two separate concepts, and absolutely, and for lots of reasons, it might be with one person. For instance, you could have somebody that has custody, the legal custody of the child, but is a traveling salesperson. But the physical custody with the other person, the reason that the traveling salesperson has legal custody is because the person that has physical custody has a mental deficiency where they can't make those decisions or they're not able to, or they are, you know, emotionally disturbed or they're bipolar or something, but this child's safe with them, but they don't have the ability to make those decisions. Absolutely. And that's why I was suggesting to Senator Ringo in that one case I have, let's just talk about what you're going to make joint decisions about and forget the label that we have on who has custody. But he's right. It is emotional for a lot of people.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Final comments or anything you'd like to say?
I just wanted to say thank you for letting me testify. And I'm sorry for bringing my testimony this afternoon. Should I drop it off at Craig Prince?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Yes, thank you very much for your time. I'm going to call David Anderson. You're from over 100 miles away. I want to get you on. And I don't know, are you related to Mary Ann Anderson?
Yes.
Okay. Try not to be, you know.
This will be very
duplicate. You know, duplicate the testimony if you can.
Mr. Chairman, members of the judiciary, I have my testimony there and it's being passed out. I'm testifying on behalf of Emily Cohen. She is a Portland area family law attorney and has been practicing for 15 years. She's represented parents and children in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties in custody, divorce, adoption, and juvenile dependency cases. Emily has observed firsthand the negative effects on children from custody disputes and has consulted with many parents who have been devastated by the perceived loss of their children through divorce. Children do not benefit by having one parent win and the other lose. Children need to know that both of their parents will be there for them. This is reinforced by frequent contact and knowing that both parents take a meaningful role in their lives. Most non-custodial parents accepted sole custody with custodial parent voluntarily because they knew that the courts would not force joint custody, and fighting for custody in a contested trial would have cost them thousands of dollars, which they didn't have. In Oregon, all one parent has to do or say is not agree to a joint custody, and our statutes, as they are now written, invite this easy means for one parent to exercise control and gain sole custody. In fact, the primary parent in a traditional marriage has no incentive under current Oregon law to agree to anything less than sole custody. In cases where parents contest custody, the attorneys and the private custody evaluators often eat up the children's college fund, the equity in the family's home, and they tap on the grandparents, too. Being a grandparent, I know that. What will the parents be left with is a deep hatred for the parent they perceive forced them into the fight. The children are virtually always the big losers. They will end up being in the sole custody of a parent who hates the other parent, and they have no hope of having a healthy relationship with both parents. The mandatory parenting class for divorcing parents has helped many parents understand the emotional pain they bring to their children when either exhibits a negative attitude toward the other parent. Under current law, mediation can be ordered by the court, but it is not mandatory. In one mediation session, if one mediation session is unsuccessful, the courts will not order parents back to further sessions to keep working. Legislation that keeps the parents' dispute out of the courts and mandates that the parents must work out their issues would help children enormously. One sees the damage caused to children so poignantly when representing children in domestic relation cases. 6 years ago, Emily was appointed by the Clackamas County Circuit Court to represent a 13-year-old girl in a custody case, where the mother sought to modify the court's award of sole custody of her then 3-year-old daughter to the father. The father acknowledged that he could understand why his 13-year-old daughter wanted to live with her mom after all these years, and he did not contest the change of custody. What amazed Emily in this case was the deep abiding hatred the parents still harbored after 10 years. Both parents told me they saved a transcript of the proceedings, the father specifically for the purpose of having his daughter read it one day. When the father openly stated to me, or to Emily, in what low regard he held the mother, Emily told him that after the change of custody, he would have to support the mother's parenting. He looked at Emily as if he couldn't believe it. 10 years after the divorce, he had no concept that the other parent might be parenting and that parents need to support each other in order to make the child's world safe. Instead of being able to support the mother's parenting, the father, using his wealth, continued to indulge his daughter and undermine the mother's efforts to set rules and limits in her home. The girl turned to drugs, emotional placebo of sex, instead of being able to live with the advantages of her intelligence and sensitivity and father's wealth. She lived with the pain of her parents' hatred for one another, and by the time she was 14, she was drug addicted and hospitalized for psychotic behavior. The courts must be the last resort for divorcing parents who cannot agree on parenting plans. When either parent can force a court trial just by being disagreeable, the children suffer many losses. First, the family finances are significantly impacted, and as said before, it is not uncommon for a parent to spend their child's college fund on attorney fees. Further, households stressed financially may well have the difficulty meeting the children's daily physical and emotional needs. Second, the children are drawn into the dispute. They become the subject of evaluations and studies and may be called upon to testify regarding their preference to one parent over the other. Third, the children lose the family they thought was going to be there forever. When the parents' energies are focused on their own conflict with the other parent, the children's needs get lost along the way. Mandated mediation in divorce cases, in conjunction with ready mandated parenting classes, would move Oregon's children toward a better future. This was submitted by Emily Cohen.
All right, thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Any questions?
I don't think so at this time, although I think she does bring one issue for us, and that is whether or not joint custody can be avoided by simply refusing to cooperate or refusing to accept joint custody. So it kind of raises the question, to what degree does the court get involved in that discussion? And do you have a response to that?
No, I'll think about it.
Okay, yeah, think about it and frame some of the legal issues here. We got Elaine Walters. You came from over 100 miles, and you're in opposition to this, so we'll hear from you so that we can just get you on.
Senator Minnis, thank you. I am here in opposition to Senate Bill 431. I'm an expert in domestic violence and child abuse issues. I've been working in Lane County for the last 12 years on these issues. I've also provided a lot of training and consultation with attorneys, judges, child care providers, CASA staff, as well as the multidisciplinary child abuse teams around the state on these issues. After listening to the Andersons speak, I also would like to acknowledge that I am a child of a very nasty custody dispute, and I have a very clear understanding of how bad this can all be. I would like to think that by putting a few words in a law that we can clean up the messy behavior of parents and order them to cooperate with one another, but in all due respect, that hasn't been most of our experiences and what's possible. I believe in this particular measure there are a number of pretty significant contradictions and problems the way this bill has been written. In particular, and I'll just refer to the sections, joint custody, the idea of joint custody or the presumption of joint custody versus another section, Section 1, Subsection 4, that grants parents and courts the widest discretion in developing a parenting plan. It basically revokes that discretion, whether it intends to or not. Section 2, Subsection 1 says a court may not approve a parenting plan unless the parenting plan ensures the opportunity for both parents to have frequent and continuing contact with the child, versus the new subsection 1 under Section 5 to assure minor children of frequent and continuing contact with parents who have shown the ability to act in the best interests of the child. Those don't mesh. Section 5, new subsection 6, says to acknowledge that both parents have a fundamental right to equal parenting time, versus Section 6, new subsection. Joint custody means an award to each parent of parenting time consistent with the division of time spent with the child by the parents before the filing of the petition for separation. So it basically contradicts itself internally. And Section 6, new subsection 3, if the court determines that both parents are fit and have the potential to cooperate, the court shall order joint custody even if both parents do not agree, versus what's already there, or versus the addition of new subsection 6 under Section 6. This is standing wording that's already in there, that says the inability or unwillingness to cooperate shall constitute a change of circumstances worthy of reconsidering. So basically, again, there's an internal contradiction between somebody who has the potential to be cooperative versus somebody who's already shown they're not being cooperative. Which way do you weigh in on this? Even if these contradictions can be addressed by rewriting or correcting the measure, I think there are some significant problems with this legislation or any legislation that creates a presumption of joint custody. Again, I don't think that you can clean up the messes that we will all drag into court to try and get help with by instituting a policy of joint custody, and be able to balance that with the language around support, working in the best interest of the child. What it basically does is it ties the courts and the parents' hands in terms of presenting information, and even though there's a rebuttable presumption, it sets the bar towards proving that somebody is unfit in order to change or contest the presumption of joint custody. And I think this takes away pretty important discretion to the court in terms of assessing what is in the best interest of the child. The other thing is, again, with great deference to the Andersons' testimony about their own granddaughter around the issues of domestic violence and substance abuse and mental health issues, I do believe that we took care of that need for being able to bring that information into a custody decision in a way that it wasn't prior to last session. To my knowledge, and I know that there were some statistics presented, I didn't catch one that really cleared this up for me, that really shows that a presumption or the mandating of joint custody can be shown as in the best interests of children, rather than using discretion and the most information available to make those decisions.
Okay. Ms. Walters, let me ask you a couple of questions, and for all the certified smart lawyers out there.
Yeah.
We have two people who are married and they have children.
Mm-hmm.
There is joint custody.
Yep.
Correct. And then they seek a dissolution of their marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it not appropriate to have a presumption of joint custody? What is it about the separation of the relationship that somehow now severs that inherent interest in the child that one is either the father or mother of? So, mm-hmm. You understand the legal question
here?
I do.
And I guess I would contest the idea that there is joint custody. We don't really know. We have people living in the same household who in some way or another are making decisions about their children. We cannot assume that they're making decisions in agreement. We can't assume that one parent or the other.
Excuse me just a second. The law assumes when they're married that they have joint decision-making power.
Right. It's sort of the default position. Yes.
And that's the law. That's the inherent mm-hmm. right that parents have with respect to their children.
Yes.
Now, once we decide we're going to dissolve the relationship legally, what is it that now severs that interest that a parent has in their child? It's a legal question, in my opinion, because I believe that a person has a particular interest, a right, if you will, to be a parent, if you are, in fact, the biological parent.
Well, and I don't think there's anything in the current law that makes it so that we can't bring that into
effect. This is the point I'm trying to raise here. The point, as was read into the record by Ms. Cohen, there's an attorney here, that if one parent then says, I don't want joint custody, and this is what I need to get into a little bit, is what is it about that statement, I don't want to cooperate, I don't want joint custody, that then sends this thing into a spiral away from the idea that joint custody is in the best interest of the child? And that's the legal issue that I'm trying to figure out. What is it about the courts that now substitute their judgment for the judgments of the parents? I do understand all the emotional conflicts and one parent hates the other and they're dissolving a relationship. Some people do and don't cooperate. In most circumstances, cooperative parents are going to have a joint relationship and they're going to enter into it agreeably, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm looking really at the raw legal question here. Mm-hmm. What is it about the state's interest when the state then steps in and says, under the authority and the color of the state, that this is what is going to happen, and that becomes the legal...
Well, ideally, people would maintain joint custody because they could continue to agree. And ideally, the court could say that both parents are in a position to be cooperative. But what this does is it actually presumes that on its face, and then it makes it a very high bar to show that people cannot function very well to do that.
Right.
And it has basically proved that somebody's unfit.
Right. And let me ask you, another question for all the certified smart lawyers out there. We have a termination of parental rights process.
Mm-hmm.
That assumes that a parent does have a right to participate in the parenting of their child. Now, we've set some very strict standards in terms of the revocation and termination of parental rights, but the courts look very, very, very strictly on this whole issue of taking that parental interest away from a parent.
So you're seeing this as a parent's rights issue?
Well, exactly. And,
uh-huh.
and what I'm saying is there is a process for terminating parental rights, which really just takes that interest completely and legally away from the parent. And there are factual circumstances.
The problem is that there's a lot in between those two.
That's exactly right, and that's mm-hmm. what I'm pointing out. This is a hybrid mm-hmm. section between the joint custody that was presumed when the two persons were married legally together, mm-hmm. and termination of parental rights. This is somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. And I guess from my perspective, if there's a presumption that there's joint custody, then the court, absent that, should have some factual basis to decide otherwise. And I think that's what the bill's trying to get to. I could be wrong, but that seems to be where they're going, that the court would have to demonstrate clear and convincing evidence that this particular parent ought not have this exercise of their rights because, and it's the because the person does.
Let me just go to my own childhood to tell you what would have happened if my parents had been awarded joint custody.
Well, look, I'm a child of divorced parents, too. I've been through it before. I was raised by my mother. I grew up, in an impoverished environment. I know all those stories. I've been a policeman for 27 years. Mm-hmm. I've seen it. I've been a domestic violence, sexual assault detective for 4.5 years, mm-hmm. a homicide detective, and I currently work sexual assault. I'm familiar with these issues.
So you understand the level of the standard that you would have to go on to prove somebody unfit.
Well, and that may be an issue, but what I'm mm-hmm. saying here is when the state of Oregon steps in and substitutes its judgment for the judgment of the parents, that is a very serious constitutional question, I think.
So your concern is that that's already happening, that parents are losing their legal, sort of God-given rights to have responsibility and control over their children.
Well, I don't know that. That's your statement.
I'm asking.
Sure. I'm looking at the abstract legal question here. There are a lot of people smarter than I am in this room,
mm-hmm.
and we'll have them come up. I'm laying these questions out so they can come up and tell me whether I'm wrong or right or why we ought to do something different. So as opposed to just leaving it as is. Now, Judge Leger came up and testified that we we can't afford to do mediation. We don't have enough money to do these things. I don't think that when you're interfering with the constitutional rights of a criminal or a parent...
That you can opt out of paying for it. Yeah.
Well, I don't think that the courts should have the privilege of saying, well, it's just too hard and we can't afford it, and therefore we're not going to do it.
Well, I think you're talking about two different things, if I may. The mediation is not an issue that people are, I feel, in opposition to. In fact, in many counties, I know there might be a fiscal impact if you mandate it in communities that don't have mediation, but I don't think that's the biggest issue on the face of this measure. I believe that most of us agree that mediation, when it's safe to do mediation, is an appropriate course of action, and that the court should be the last resort. And we're still going to be the courts are still going to be the last resort. And when you mandate a presumption, you basically take away the discretion of the court to review issues in terms of the best interests of the child. Now,
let me make a point here. I mm-hmm. disagree with that point, because what we're really saying, or what the bill seems to be saying, is that the court has to make its decision. It's not that it can't make its decision. It has to make it on a factual basis.
And the wording in this law says that has to be
the judgment of the court. You understand
right.
what I'm saying?
I do. And the wording of this particular measure puts that standard at proving that one of the parents is unfit. And maybe that's something that you're willing right. to play with, but right. what it does is it actually sets a mandatory option for the court that can only be contested if you can prove that one of the parents is unfit. You don't any longer have to prove that the joint custody is in the best interest of the child, and you can't then use the argument that it's not in the best interest of the child to contest the joint custody order in the wording of this bill. And I believe that that takes away significant discretion from early childhood experts, from custody evaluators, from judges who are skilled in making these kinds of decisions. It raises the bar beyond
right.
them.
And I don't disagree with what you're saying. I'm just saying that if you have persons who are evaluating, doing a home study, for instance, mm-hmm. the home study ought to be based on factual circumstances.
Absolutely.
And it ought to be done. It ought not be based on conjecture.
Well, and in California, which has been touted around a little bit as a model, one of the things that has to happen there for somebody to be licensed as qualified as a custody evaluator is a significant amount of training that our courts and custody evaluators right. don't even have to have. So I think if you're trying to look at the best interests of the child and at making decisions based on fact, that there's a training issue and a resource issue that isn't addressed by this measure.
And I think you raise another very important point, and that is that oftentimes judges do have to rely on the expertise of individuals
Absolutely.
Who have done.
And they're not necessarily skilled.
Of studies, exactly. And so I don't want to put a lot of blame on the courts, because at the same time
Absolutely.
They do have to rely on these judgments and decisions.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Anybody else have a question, comment, political dissertation, diatribe, et cetera, et cetera? No. Ms. Walters, thank you very much for your testimony. All right. Looking around here a little bit. Let's go to Ken. Is it Shung Leffel? Help me, I can't quite pronounce this.
Shung Leffel.
Shung Leffel.
Yes, Mr. Thank Chair. You. Let me just pass these out real quick for you. Chairman Menas and Senators, first of all, it's wonderful that you've allowed for a hearing on this very important topic. As you might know, this topic has been an issue of discussion for probably about 15 to 20 years. I've been intimately involved with presumptive joint custody as an issue for probably about the last 11 to 12 years. A quick little background is that I had authored an initiative about 11 years ago on this issue. It originally had the support of the Multnomah County Democratic Legislative Central Committee, as well as AFSCME. It also had the Washington County Republican Party had circulated it as an initiative. And I think one of the primary reasons that this was done so is because they realized for many years that there's a very big problem in our family law courts, which promotes an adversarial process. Now, I know a little bit, I'm not going to read my testimony, of course, it's 7 pages long, but I did kind of outline a little bit about the history of child custody, which I can just briefly go over in the sense that prior to the turn of the century, only men were allowed to have custody of their children. This was wrong. But then there was, as a result of the advent of the Industrial Revolution, it also changed and swung the other way, as I explained in there how the World Health Organization and all got involved and felt that men were very insignificant as well in the care of their children, and the pendulum swung the other way where only women were allowed to get custody of their children. And then, of course, now as I like to look at it, since both men and women are being awarded sole custody of their children today, I still look at it as being somewhat equally discriminatory, and there's some significant changes that need to take place. Now, Senator Menas made probably one of the most, I think he got right to the point on what the real problem exists in our child custody laws today. And it's dealing with the issue of the cooperative parent, or this issue in regards to if one parent objects. Now, in my research over the years, I had also I became aware of the fact that now, understandably, the Oregon State Bar has taken a position in the past, and the judges, to oppose having parents be awarded custody over the objections of another parent. But this is a self-defeating idea that was created in the late 80s by a committee that was put together by the Oregon State Bar, because they knew they had to recognize joint custody. And so the best way that I believe that it could have been sabotaged, and although all lawyers that were serving on that committee did not agree to this, they did win because there was more votes that agreed to it as opposed to the others. But the American Bar Association actually is opposed to the very same thing that we adhere to here in Oregon. I talked with an attorney years ago that was a member of the ABA. His name was Jeff Atkinson, and he's also listed in my testimony. And the reason why the ABA had opposed this is because, in his words, and as the committee on the ABA that met over this topic said, it allows one parent absolute veto power over the other parent regardless. Now, a couple places where this can be looked upon, now how this can work, we must first understand that the rule of thumb in determining child custody today is based upon what I like to call the possession doctrine, which is also, my mouth's a little dry here, so I may sound a little cotton mouth, but with the legal ease, or the legal term for that, is called primary caretaker. What we do is reward the parent that first decides they want a divorce and can initiate what, having a background in the military of 18 years and still involved, I like to use the term preemptive strike. Now, I believe preemptive strikes, from a military point of view, is a very, thank you, is a very valid position to take at times if you're looking to win a battle. But I don't believe that parents should be poised in a position of a battlefield. And that's exactly what we encourage. Now, if you look at the law that I believe that we have been in conflict with for years, it says the policy of this state in Section 5 on page 3 and Section 5, paragraph 2, is to encourage parents to share in the rights and responsibilities of raising their children after the parents have separated or have dissolved their marriage. I think a good question to bring up to the legal community is, under the current laws, what do you do to encourage this? Is there any possible areas where we discourage it? Well, yes, we do discourage it. We discourage it because we have that one area in effect which says, upon the objections of one parent, there can be no joint custody. Regardless of how good the other parent is, it's a possession doctrine issue. It's a matter of who legally steals, possibly, those children first, before there's any court orders, can win custody of those children. Now, like I had said, I am presently involved with the military. I just got a chance to start reading this this morning because I just got home, actually, this weekend, and Marianne had made contact with me on this testimony coming up. So I'm very grateful that she notified me, and I wanted to get down here to try and testify on it. I want to use a couple examples of some military people that are presently affected by this. There's one, I'm an instructor out at the Oregon Military Academy, and one of our soldiers out there who's a full-timer, he actually has full custody of his children. His wife lives out of state. He believes it would be a noble thing. He would like to cooperate and agree to joint custody. However, if he were to agree to joint custody, under the current law, all his ex-spouse would have to do, once she had possession of the children, find some reason why not to return them children, establish the primary caretaker status, and have, for the graciousness of his sharing, to have that eventually be overturned. That can be done. And if you believe it can't be done, there's a case referred to as Swilling versus Swilling, which is also listed in my testimony, probably on like the second or third page, page 3. Yes, page 3 at the bottom. And I won't go into that, but in this particular case, it was a mother that it happened to that shared custody with the father. And I've heard of these cases over and over throughout the years where a parent would eventually share custody who normally had access to full custody, and because they were cooperating, then they eventually end up, how do we reward them? By losing custody of their children. There's another case of an individual that was a military soldier. It's a story that kind of circulates in military circles about a soldier that was overseas during Desert Storm. And as I tell you this story, keep in mind that we have about 2,000 Oregon Army National Guard soldiers. That
Mr. Shumway, if you could just kind of
wrap it up, certainly,
We have several witnesses who are going to try.
Certainly, I will do that. I'll tell you, rather than going into all that, what I will say is that there's a couple things that I do agree that there's probably a couple things on here, and I've talked with Marianne over and a couple other people, and there might be a couple things in here that might need some adjustments. That is fine. I think we can all agree to that. But there's one thing that we really need to hold to the heart of it, and I would hope that in agreeing to this, if you decide that possibly a work study was even to come up in regards to this, or work session, that the one thing that you would all hold to that is very important is that we need to eliminate this point in the law which says that one parent should have absolute veto power over the other parent, as well as on page 3 under section 4 paragraph 3 another part in there where it also says including mental disability. I would probably say that a friendly amendment to that should also, maybe instability might be a better term, because I don't know if people that, just because they have ADHD or something like that, I don't think that should eliminate them from being parents to their children. So, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Sorry, I missed your testimony. Could you tell everybody on the committee when you ran against me for office 2 years ago what your campaign slogan was?
Yes. My campaign slogan was elect Schamlepel, not a Republican, not a Democrat, not even a lawyer.
Those signs were all over the area.
And I might also add that the Libertarian Party has actually endorsed this concept of presumptive joint custody, so it's something that they never cared to hear about until recently. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, we'll have Sybil Hepp from the Oregon Law Center. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Minnis in absentia and members of the committee, I'm glad to be here today. My name is Sybil Hebb. I'm a family law support unit attorney with the Oregon Law Center, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Law Center and on behalf of low-income family law litigants we represent. We're in opposition to Senate Bill 431. Because we fear that by creating a presumption of joint custody, even over parents' objection, the bill would mandate a really drastic shift in Oregon's current custody laws, which are exemplary and are the result of a great deal of input and research from a broad spectrum of practitioners and experts. And we believe that that shift would inappropriately curtail the judges or the court's ability to address the best interests of children. I'll try to respond to the testimony that we heard before and some of the questions that have been raised, and also be happy to entertain any questions from the committee. Basically, most experts agree in current research that any legal presumption establishing any one-size-fits-all custody solution is inappropriate and harmful to children in many circumstances. It's families and children are clearly unique and made up of individuals, and any custodial arrangement that's imposed by a court should, in order to be successful, be crafted so as to meet those specific needs. This principle is supported by common sense, but also by research as embodied in the 1996 report of the U.S. Commission on Child and Family Welfare that's entitled Parenting Our Children in the Best Interests of the Nation. And there was both a majority and a minority report to out of that commission. I didn't make 25 copies because it's 54 pages long, but I have a copy here for the committee if anyone's interested, and I'd be happy to provide it. That report quotes a broad spectrum of nationwide experts, both children and family law experts, who agree that custody and parenting time decisions need to be tailored to meet the needs of families and individuals, and they caution against making any general assumptions about the appropriateness of any particular agreement or arrangement. Aside from that, as previous testifiers have touched on, joint custody presumptions may actually be dangerous in many circumstances. Given what we know about the percentage of family law litigants who are unrepresented and going through a complicated and sometimes intimidating court process on their own without the advice of legal counsel, subjecting them to a presumption which they have to overcome by various technical means may place an inappropriate burden on people in many circumstances, particularly the great number of people who face issues of domestic violence, substance abuse, mental instability, as quoted in the statute, but many other circumstances as well. And parents with concerns, safety concerns about themselves and about their children should not be put in a situation in which they have to overcome a substantial and complicated burden in order to have the court look at what truly is should be designed to meet the needs of their specific circumstances. Also, research shows that joint custody arrangements, the success of those arrangements, really depends upon a parent's ability to cooperate and communicate. And as has been stated before, we unfortunately have not found a way to create those skills where they don't exist simply by putting a label to them or creating a particular structure for them. Joint custody arrangements clearly are ideal in some circumstances and for some families, and it would be ill-advised for courts to not to recognize that But where there's parental conflict for a lack of cooperation skills, a lack of co-parenting skills, putting families into a situation in which they must deal with one another over a broad range of decisions, even the smallest to the greatest, puts children right at the center of conflict. And research shows, as I indicated, that high conflict situations are terrible for children, especially when they're at the center of those conflicts.
Can I ask a question, please, Mr. Chair? As I said earlier, I think the bill has some problems and needs some work, but I am wondering whether, in your experience, there is a stigma attached to the non-custodial parent that is part of the reason for the conflict, and is there a way to somehow address that?
I appreciate your comments, Senator Ringo, Chairman, and members of the committee. And the research, as indicated in this report, does indicate that it would be best if custody arrangements or if court decisions could move away from using terms like custody or non-custodial. And they also recommended that courts move away from using the term visitation and recommended instead parenting plan instead. And Oregon has adopted that recommendation previously.
In your opinion, would it be possible to craft the system so that rather than designating a non-custodial parent, the parenting plan simply include all the important grants of authority, including the ability to make important medical decisions, education decisions, and the life decisions?
I think that it would be possible to envision such a structure whereby, for example, a parenting plan would designate where the child would primarily spend time or not, depending on what the arrangement was that was best suited to fit the needs, and who would have decision-making power or what types of decision-making power power is the wrong word to use, but how that arrangement would work out. Yeah. And I believe that if the state were able to look at a broad range of perspective and input and talk to experts, that it's possible to come up with a solution that would address some of those concerns.
But just one more. But just so that I mean, do you think that the label non-custodial is a problem in and of itself? Or not really? I mean, people get past that, and that's not the problem.
Senator Ringo, Chairman, and members of the committee, I guess I think that in my experience, that label is a problem for some people. For the most part, though, it seems to me that mature, cooperative individuals can overlook any of that stuff, and if they get along and can do the right thing for their kids,
yeah,
the labels are less important.
Okay, thank you.
So,
thank you. Are you done with your just one?
I had a few more remarks, but I'd love to take questions however you prefer.
Okay, if you could make it as quick as possible,
okay,
we can get another
Okay. I'll just move to wrap up the 1987 Family Law Section Executive Committee's Joint Custody Task Force took about a year to look at this issue intensively, consulting, as I said, a broad range of experts, and they came up with Oregon's current structure, which is designed to address primarily the best interests of the children, and that is the overall consideration that guides the courts, and we believe that experience has shown that that's the appropriate consideration to guide the courts, and that the nationwide report that was done in 1996 indicated that Oregon was sort of had an exemplary structure, because not only did it establish the best interests of the child as the standard and allow the court to craft individual solutions, it also gave some structure or guidance to the court as to the kinds of things that the court should consider in determining the best interests. And that was described as the best case scenario, as giving some guided instruction about how to consider the best interests. And I think it would be a mistake to revise that in such a drastic manner without doing intensive research. I just wanted to also respond to what I believe, or I understood, Senator Minnis's questions to be about the standards that apply, and clarify that I think that the standards that we are that we've been hearing so much about in previous years about the fundamental rights of parents have come up within the context of cases that involve parents versus non-parents third parties or the state. And there the courts have been very clear that the standard needs to be incredibly high. When the cases involve parents versus parents, it's clear that the courts have authority to substitute their decisions or to make a decision when the parents are unable to do that themselves. And one of the other recommendations of this nationwide report was that a court system, in a best case scenario, would encourage parents to come up with their own decisions and provide parents with tools by which to do that. And Oregon has made many steps in the past number of years to provide parenting education, mediation, and other resources to encourage parents to do their own decision making. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify here.
Thank you. We'll move on to the next witness unless there are burning questions. Meg Goldberg.
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I went to law school with Meg, so everything she says must be right.
And the same for Mr. Ringo.
These lawyers stick together.
Oh, no, those lawyers stick together like glue. First one, we're in the same class. So, thank you, Chairman Minnis and members of the committee, for allowing me to have testimony today. I've submitted a two-page document, and we'll be just wanting to actually answer some questions and make some comments different from my testimony. I'm Meg Goldberg. I'm a family mediator in Portland in private practice. I'm also on the court panel in Columbia County as a family law mediator. At this time, I think there's three of us on the court panel, so it is a small county, small group of people we work with. I'm also a member of Oregon State Bar, inactive member of the New Mexico State Bar, a member of the Oregon Mediation Association, and the convener of the Family Mediation Interest Group. And having listened to questions from the committee and other testimony, I'm hoping that maybe my expertise as a mediator would be helpful for the committee this morning. I was pleased to hear mediation come up in different contexts. And as we know, currently, the current Oregon state statutes allow for judges to order families into mediation when joint custody is at issue. And many a times I'm asked to meet with families, with parents, when that is really the only thing that's left at issue for parents to have to resolve. So I believe is that the courts and attorneys have really come around in the last 10 years to embrace mediation and to see that it can be useful in some but not in all circumstances. As a mediator, because this is one of the things that was addressed, is really what happens in mediation. Mediators are neutral or impartial third persons. We don't take sides and we don't make judgments as to the parties that are in mediation. Mediation really is a forum to allow for the parents to be self-determining and to make decisions that are good for them. And I believe that all of us believe, including the courts, attorneys, community, is that parents really know what's best for their children. And given the right circumstances, even in the reality of divorce, is that they can make good decisions for their children. And there are certain situations in which some parents aren't able to do that. The emotions are too high. There may be mental health issues. There may be control issues. There may be substance abuse issues. Other things that may be driving conflict that's too great for parents to say, we can come together, we can be cooperative, we can be collaborative and make good decisions for ourselves and for our children. And at that point in time, then that's what the next step is for attorneys to help in negotiations. And then really the last step is really that the court steps in with, I believe, some help from custody evaluators, psychologists, and other people that come in and help the court make recommendations to make final decisions around divorce and parenting plans. Mediation is voluntary, and it means that even though if someone's ordered into mediation, because it is voluntary in nature, is that people don't have to be in mediation if they don't want to be. My experience has been people come in and go, well, attorneys told us to be here, the judge's ordered us in here, I don't really want to be here. And I said, well, are you willing to give it a chance? And they do. And they find is, you know what, we don't like each other, But that's okay, because we can create structure, and within that is we don't have to like each other, but we can still be good parents. And we don't have to communicate with each other unless it's around parenting our children. And that's been really helpful, because now we can get away and disentangle ourselves from what brought us into the divorce and get along with our lives and still have good plans for our kids. It's also in mediation that's really important is that there's power balancing. And one of the questions came up, I think, with Ms. Anderson's testimony and some questions after that was, what do you do with issues around domestic violence, or if there is such a great imbalance because one person does, again, have substance abuse issues or mental health issues or something of that sort, is that mediation is not the magic source for every family situation. And again, that's where the power should go back to the courts to be able to help families make some final decisions. Yes?
At the risk of being rude, I want to maybe cut you off at
okay.
this point. And it's not that I won't invite you. We've got other people who signed up that we're not going to get to.
Okay.
And I don't want to offend Senator Ringo, since you're colleagues of the same law school. But
yeah.
I think the points you're making about mediation are very important, and probably should hear a little bit more about this. But I'm going to, at this point, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 431. The persons that signed up
okay.
who wanted to testify, if you'll give your addresses or your information to the clerk, will make sure that you're notified of the next hearing on the bill so that you'll have a chance to come back, and we'll see where we go in terms of this bill and what its outcomes might be. I want to try to get to a couple of other bills if I can. So
okay. And one question,
sure,
if I may, is it possible to submit additional testimony?
Absolutely.
Okay, and
absolutely.
When would be the closing time?
And if you did bring written testimony and you don't want to come back, you can submit that written testimony for the record also.
Okay.
We'll have that, okay?
Great. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I appreciate your time. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 413. Committee, I want to try to rush through a couple of things if possible with your indulgence. Public hearing on Senate Bill 104. Mr. Livingston is here from the Department of Justice Council. If you'll tell us what this bill does.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 104 is a cleanup from last session's House Bill 2336. 2336 was an attempt in the juvenile code to make sure that we have a system for appealing judgments. And if you look at Senate Bill 104, you're going to have a -1 amendment that basically takes away everything except for what was formerly Section 2 of the bill. This bill, Mr. Livingston has been working with Mr. Travis, who had Senate Bill 69. The reason this has been amended is to make sure that these two bills do not conflict. Basically, what these amendments do is they will make sure and make it clear that the delinquency code and appeals from judgments in delinquency cases in juvenile court will follow the same system that was set up in 2336. That is why the term youth is found in what is now Section 1 of the bill. If you have the -1 amendments, you'll see what I'm talking about.
All right. We have the -1. Mr. Livingston, why don't you tell us why we're doing this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in 2001, the Judicial Department submitted a bill, 2336, that amended the Juvenile Code Appeal Statute to conform with the civil appeals to the extent that appeals were from judgments where they previously had been from orders of the juvenile court. In drafting that statute, the Judicial Department made an error because it left out appeals from judgments in delinquency cases. Under the statute read technically now, only appeals from dependency case judgments can be maintained. What Senate Bill 7104 does is correct that error. The -1 amendments are there just to harmonize Senate Bill 104 with 69, which you heard about this morning. And there is, in addition to Section 2, there's an emergency clause here because it is an error that needs to be corrected right away. And Mr. Jim Nass, of the who's the legal counsel to the appellate court, has informed me that he supports this bill.
Thank you very much. We'll open a close public hearing, open a work session. If no one else signed up on the bill, Senator Verdi,
your chairman.
Yes, ma'am.
I move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 104.
Senator Verdi moves the adoption of the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 104. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Verdi.
Chairman, I move Senate Bill 104 to the Senate as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Verdi now moves Senate Bill 104 to the floor of the Senate as amended to the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. And any volunteers here? Senator Starr will carry the bill. Thank you very much. Senator Ringo, you have another meeting that you have to run to. Do the other committee members have a couple of minutes, or if not? You do? Okay, I think full service vice chairman, I like that. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 628, Ginger Martin, Department of Corrections.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as Ms. Martin's coming up, this bill has also been amended substantively. You should have the dash one amendments to it. This bill relates to child abuse reports and an issue that Corrections Department, from which Ms. Martin is coming today, has dealt with trying to get evidence or reports of child abuse in the hands of law enforcement who are managing the people who have been accused and been found to have been abusers.
Ms. Martin.
Chair Minnis, members of the Judiciary Committee, I'm Ginger Martin of the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to provide information and support for Senate Bill 621 and the Dash 1 Amendment. This bill authorizes the release of records to related to the investigation of child abuse to a number of law enforcement-related agencies, including the Department of Corrections and community corrections agencies, and also allows those reports to be shared between corrections agencies. The Dash 1 amendments make it clear that law enforcement agencies doing the investigation will release reports only to certain criminal justice agencies rather than to the broad list of people and agencies that were included in the original bill. In current law, these records are confidential and may not be released to corrections agencies. Access to this information is important to us so that we might more reliably assess the risk that may be associated with a particular offender. For example, information about predatory behavior or sex offenses against children may be included in these records. This information is necessary to determine which inmates might be released on work crews, if an inmate in prison or an offender in the community should be restricted from interaction with child victims, and the type of correctional programs that might best address their future criminal behavior. During community supervision and a time of transition from prison to community, this information is needed to set special conditions of supervision, to assess the need for community or victim notification, and for use in sex offender treatment and polygraphs. Without the information contained in these reports, the Department of Corrections, the Board of Parole, and county community corrections agencies must rely on the offender and his or her version of the crime and accurate or more likely inaccurate disclosure of the facts. The information needed now does exist in law enforcement agencies. We think public safety is much better served if this information can be released and shared between corrections agencies, and this is why Department of Corrections supports this legislation as reflected in the Dash 1 amendments.
All right, with the Dash 1 amendments, correct. All right, thank you very much. Any questions, Ms. Martin? Ms. Skye? You're signed up in opposition.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And I signed up to oppose the bill based on the original draft, which we had grave concerns with. We feel much better with the amended version, although I do want to raise just a couple of concerns. And that is that there are included in this information that will be released are a number of reports for unfounded or uncharged conduct. So there could be, if a person, a crime was reported, child abuse or neglect, it was investigated, it was unfounded, no criminal charge was filed, that report's been set aside, the case is closed. Those types of reports, the offender themselves may not even know the existence of those reports, and they certainly would never have access to those reports themselves. However, those reports are now going to be released to these agencies and, in theory, used to restrict their liberty without them having any knowledge of what those reports are. And there are a number of concerns there. One is if they are used to set special conditions of supervision. For example, in a probation case, if a person is being supervised by the Department of Community Corrections and they set a condition that's related to conduct that's in a report that the offender has no knowledge of, the defense attorney obviously has no knowledge of it, and the court who's supervising that probation has no knowledge of it, I think that there would be a due process need there for these reports to be released to the attorney in that situation. And I have spoken with
Mr. Van Valkenburg, who's here from the AG's office, and those records may then be released by the court under a due process analysis. But my general concern is not so much with the reports on the that result in a conviction, but the reports that result in no conviction and are unfounded, that those reports, the offender has no knowledge of the contents of those reports, and they are subsequently being used against them or used to restrict their liberty. And that's the concerns that we have.
Thank you, Kelly. Senator Farrelly.
Mr. Chairman, I think that Ms. Kelly raises an interesting issue. The records that are being kept can be in several different categories, founded versus unfounded, substantiated in investigation, by investigation. That's one series of reports. Another set of reports are unfounded. They're still kept by the agency. And the testimony, as far as I can determine, is accurate, that indicates that the object of those reports may never have been aware of those reports. And it does seem to me to be a little Orwellian, that behavioral limitations and other post-conviction considerations could be made based on information in files that is not founded, where there's been no due process, and where in fact the principal may not even be aware that those charges were made. So it does raise a due process question. I'm wondering if some of those questions might be answered if the only records that were shared were actually related to investigated, founded reports rather than the other kind of reports.
Chairman, Senator Farrelly, I just want to clarify so that I haven't misled anybody. The original bill would have allowed the Department of Human Services to distribute records that they have, and this bill does not allow that. It allows the law enforcement agencies. So we are just talking about police reports, and technically some of those police reports might back up investigations that had labels of founded or unfounded under the Department of Human Services. But we're only talking about the actual police reports, is my understanding, with this bill. But you're right. Some of those reports may back up unfounded allegations. Certainly, if they never resulted in criminal charges, that there are a number of reasons. That it could be that they just weren't able to procure the evidence to prosecute that at that time, or it may be that it was investigated and the person was determined to be not guilty or innocent of
or already incarcerated. I mean, I've got a case where a guy's doing 25 years, and you identify via DNA that this is the perpetrator of a rape. The victim couldn't identify, so the only evidence you have is DNA. And when you talk to the victim, you say, well, here's the deal. We now know who the suspect is based on DNA, but this person's also serving 25 years in the penitentiary for something else. Do you want to prosecute? The victim says, I don't think so. And that happens oftentimes when they're already serving long periods of time. So your question may be, I think, appropriate when you're bringing in records that really have no relevance to the individual they're asking the records for. My experience with the Department of Corrections is they oftentimes ask for police reports directly related to the conviction that they're currently serving in. Persons that are out of my caseload or currently in the penitentiary, they'll call me and want me to release the records to the Department of Corrections. Our records division will not give them the records without my release, so that they can better supervise inside the prison the circumstances why that person is there and what the circumstances of the case were. So that's the context that I understand the bill to try to address.
And Chairman, I can't think of a good argument to oppose that portion of it. It is the reports that I was talking about. Perhaps a person is listed as a suspect, a report is written, they're investigated, but their DNA turns out to clear them in a particular crime. If the fact that they were cleared in that crime is not contained in the reports, then those reports can be sent on and used against a person who may not know that they exist and doesn't have an opportunity to bring forward the fact that, they determined that was my brother and not me. So that's our concern with this bill.
All right. Thank you very much. Then I think what we'll do is bring this back at a later time. We're 10 minutes after the hour. We've got the Associate Justice of the Supreme Court sitting in my committee, so he's here to see someone or whatever wants to talk. But we're going to go ahead and adjourn, and we'll bring this back. I think if you want to talk to Kelly Skye about her concerns and perhaps there's a way we can address it. We'll try to do that. We're adjourned.